Welcome to Art If, the podcast about art, life, and everything in between. Welcome to episode 13 of the Art If podcast.
I'm Yossi.
And I'm Hattie. In this week's gallery, we talk about art and improvisation. How improvisation is perceived by artists and spectators, and how improvisation can help us transform the world around us.
Then we interview breakdancer, rapper, and jazz pianist Bill Perry.
And as always, we end with a provocation. This week, we ask you to try something new.
And if you love this podcast, hit that subscribe button to get the latest episodes and minisodes. We thank you in advance for clicking that subscribe button. So go ahead, click it right now. Subscribe. Subscribe.
All right, so art and improvisation. Yossi.
Yes, so I purposefully stayed away from like acting and improv
so
and improv and theater.
I.
Because I just figured I didn't think he would do it. I kind of felt like we both would veer, but a part of why this is fun for me is the research aspect.
Yeah,
potentially.
Learning something new.
Yeah, so I like just admitted about how much of a nerd I am.
Yeah, but intentionally create homework for ourselves.
Yeah, right. So, yes. So I'd like to talk about live painting.
Oh,
yes. Do you know what live painting is?
I know of some examples. Flana has two really lovely large paintings that were, I think, gifted to her by someone who live paints, like, okay, at, like, a bar or something at night to whatever music is playing. And I think, in theory, he's kind of responding to the music.
That's right. That's usually how it goes, yeah.
And I've also done it myself as painting exercises.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Like, in front of people or...
No.
Just, like, in your own space?
Yeah. So, like, you play a soundtrack, and you sort of start at the top of the canvas, and you try and paint the music.
Okay.
And so it's kind of, yeah. So it's not, like, a performance of painting. I mean, I guess, like, with Paint and Sip, it's kind of live painting.
Yeah, but that's
really
that's
scripted.
Not quite what I'm, right. And that has, like, a set goal in mind, and you're teaching a play. And, like, yes, it's a live experience, but So live painting, yes. So where I saw it first was when I did the Tucson Fringe Festival. One of the shows was called the Free Baja Spectacular. And it was like music and poetry. It was kind of a variety show. And each one of the shows, there was a live painter. There were three different paintings because they had done three shows that looked very different based on how the night went. And that was the first time I had seen it.
Cool.
And it's cool because it's a part of the ambiance, right? Like seeing an artist's work, the choices they're making, the paint, and it's responsive. Like you can see how certain notes perhaps get translated onto the canvas.
Neat.
And so usually it is with a live music event or when you on YouTube videos, it's usually with music, like the examples that you can find on YouTube. Now, what I find really interesting about this, and I think that this gets to the crux of what improvisation is for me or is to me or what it's trying to capture. And it has, so live painting now is a very popular thing at weddings and at corporate events. Now, granted, COVID has changed this, but a lot of what comes up is you hire a live painter to paint live at your wedding. So over the course of the 3 or 4 hours, they're like making a painting that
I love that
reflects. Yeah, there's something really lovely about it. And same with the corporate events. Like, they'll do it, and then it'll be put up for auction, and then whoever buys it, the money goes to charity, something like that. So a lot of, and you see a lot of websites of painters who offer this service.
Cool.
So what is improvisation?
Yeah.
Right? It's about liveness. It's about capturing a moment in time, or sort of the feelings of a moment in time, even.
Yeah, sort of responding to and being present in that moment. It's also having a set of skills that you already are comfortable with that you can deploy and manipulate in different ways to respond to that moment. Because you can't...
Right, and I think that's like the artist's take on it, right? But I'm thinking about it as like, okay, say I'm hosting, you know, a milestone birthday or anniversary or wedding, and I hire a live painter. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to capture that moment in an abstract way to take home with me.
Yeah.
Which you can't do.
Right.
In some ways, right? Like, in terms of live performance, it's ephemeral. So it becomes this sort of document.
Yeah.
Of the live performance. And they're often very performative. I mean, especially the ones on YouTube, like the paint strokes are large and some of the way the painting looks, you can tell that they're aware that they're being watched. Uh-huh. And it occurs sometimes in like performance art as well. The other thing I was thinking a lot about in terms of live painting is Benjamin's concept of aura.
Oh, interesting. I thought you were going to go with the flaneur.
Oh, how would I go with the flaneur? Now let's...
Because it's about a journey. It's about exploring and movement. But yeah, go ahead. You do yours.
It's so funny. As we're talking about this, you keep taking the position of like the artist perspective on the live painting. Because I'm thinking about it in terms of the perceiver's response or the audience response. And what made me think of aura is, right, Benjamin writes that the aura of a painting exists in the, like, live co-presence with the artwork.
Okay.
And it's only contingent. The aura is created because we can now make copies of it, right? In the age of mechanical reproduction, now the original has an aura that the others don't.
Oh, okay.
So, like, when you're looking at it, you're like, wow, this is really Van Gogh's Starry Night. I can't believe it. I've seen a million versions of it, but this is different because I'm in front of it.
Also, it's different because of the texture and, right, the dimensionality that you don't get in a reproduction.
Totally. Totally. But it's also about, like, the star power.
No, you're totally right.
There's something about, like, the artist touched this and now I'm looking at, he literally took a brush on this.
Yeah. It's about encountering that celebrity. Because the painting is a celebrity, essentially.
But then with live painting, it does something interesting in that it, like, allows you to encounter time.
Okay.
Especially if you were there. So if it's your wedding or your event and you buy it, you can re-encounter not only the art. I don't know. It changes the aura so that the meeting of co-presence was not only in the viewing of it, but also in the making of it.
Right. There's a way in which you're involved in the making of it.
Right.
I think it's a lot.
Even though you're not necessarily, right. But you were there.
But I think it's very similar when a collector takes the effort or makes a point to always meet the artist. Even like non-collectors, just like normal people, when you're traveling and touring, being a tourist or whatever, when you purchase a souvenir and you're like, no, but the person behind that little table actually made this and I spoke with them and I learned their story, and that infuses it with a different aura than if you were to buy something off the shelf at Target.
Totally. Right. Yeah. That's still like, some things are still like handmade, right, that come to Target, but we don't know, it's faceless.
Right.
Right. So it is, I think it's just, it is like that. It is about like time, not only in the moment of reception, but of like conception.
Yeah. There's something interesting about, because this is a product of an improvisation and you were there, you want it to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so true. With improvisation, there's so much possibility for it to fail. But regardless of what this painting looks like, it's special.
Definitely. Like, I was actually just going to counter you. I don't even think it needs to be good because it's special.
No, but you think it's good. Right? Yeah. Okay. Special. It's right, meaningful.
Like,
someone
else might see it and just say, like, what is this abstract mess of paint? But you're like, that is my wedding.
Right. It is. Right. Which is also a hot mess, probably.
we're just deeper into quarantine. We're just getting more and more cynical. But anyways, so that's the thinking about improvisation made me think a lot about time and trying to capture, responding in time and trying to capture time. And I just think everything gets corporatized too. So there's another little, you know what I'm going to say.
Are you a Marxist?
Yeah, there you go. Another little bit. So that's my thing.
Fun.
Yeah.
Well, I also, I don't know. I feel like I approached this topic very differently than some of the others. because, like you, I was avoiding the theater stuff and, like, actual improv comedy and things like that. And I also was trying to remind myself that when I approach these things, I'm like, how does this topic help me understand art? Or how does art help me understand this topic? So Joel set me on my path to finding the thing that I wanted to talk about.
Okay.
Because he's really good at brainstorming with me on these things. But we were watching Forged in Fire again, the knife-making show.
Yep.
And there was a Marine on there who referenced this slogan, improvise, adapt, and overcome.
Okay. I don't know that slogan.
Yeah, it's a Marine thing.
Okay.
That's like one of their ways of approaching war.
So, okay.
Improvise, adapt, and overcome.
Okay. I mean, that's just good advice for a lot of people in any field.
Yeah. But it took me down this like pathway that I would not have normally, I think, gone down. And so Joel started talking about how one of the enduring ideas behind war strategy is a battle plan rarely survives past the first engagement.
Mm.
And so military folks are relying heavily on improvising. And so the general will have this sort of grand outline. But when it comes to the battalions on the ground, there's a lot of improvisation in terms of deploying that general strategy.
Okay. General, both in terms of not specific and
yeah. General. I also didn't want to just like talk about war.
Fair enough. I mean,
so from here, I Googled improvised art is what I put into the Google search bar. And the first thing, I'm not kidding you, that came up was improvised artillery in the Syrian Civil War.
Okay. So I actually have recently, last week, read a lot about the Syrian Civil War for my Middle Eastern Peoples class I'm taking for my minor in Arabic.
So, oh, interesting.
So is that what you're going to talk about?
Only kinda.
Okay.
I told you, I didn't have a really, it's just rambling.
That's fine. We're improvising here. I'm curious to see the path. Okay. So improvised artillery in the Syrian Civil War.
Yeah. So I read this article and there's, I mean, I don't want to like valorize necessarily war, but like they're doing some cool and interesting things with these weapons.
Okay.
So when you're asking, right, what is improvising, some of the things that I came upon were making sure that you have a skill set in that particular area that you can devise and manipulate some level of planning.
Right, like you have to have the foundation or some sort of like knowing what you can. I mean, granted, my jazz musician days were very limited in the 8th grade jazz band, but we did improvise. So you had to, like, know the key, and you had to know what notes you could play within the key to improvise your solo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some sort of plan.
Okay.
Limitations. In improv theater, these are usually limitations of context, right? Mm-hmm. Sort of world building. But here we're going to be looking at limitations of resources in particular.
Okay.
And the forethought, the ability to anticipate the consequences of what you're improvising, right? How will this impact the big story?
And I feel like that fourth one, sorry if I'm stealing your thunder, is maybe the one we don't think about with improvised art as much?
Probably. I mean, well, with live painting, it's short term. But in improv comedy, for example, a lot of times, especially long form improv comedy, they are thinking about that.
The impact?
Of this moment on future moments of the long form.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. And so maybe in live painting too, you're responding to the music and also leaving space for what will come.
Right, because you can't just paint the whole thing black in the first notes and then.
Right. There were two interesting pieces of artillery that came up in this article that I thought were worth talking about. Well, because they're rebel groups, they don't have access to, like, real military things in the market that they can, you know, purchase.
Right.
And So, for example, one of the things that's really important in war are tanks.
Okay.
And you can't really trade those on the black market. Like, people will
tell. That's pretty big.
They're,
you're like,
they're hard to hide.
I got this thing under a sheet, you know? I'm not going to tell you what it is. You can tell what it is, but I'm not going to tell you what it is.
So they take normal pickup trucks and then just plant whatever kind of big weapon they can on the back.
Oh, I've seen that. Now that you say that, I've totally seen images of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so these can be like rocket launch systems or anti-aircraft carriers or even just machine guns. And it makes these now, they're called technicals, but these sort of like war tank kind of things much more mobile, so they're kind of sneaky and can do these sneaky attacks. Mm-hmm. But because they're so mobile, if they have something like a rocket launch system, it means that when the gun goes off, it like blows
they
the
like
truck back
out of there. Yeah,
can't like hold itself. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is improvised armored vehicles, where because they don't have actual tanks, they're adding metal plating to these trucks to
like
add
corrugated
an extra
steel
shield
or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then because it blocks out the windows, they set up closed circuit television systems and control the weaponry with PlayStations.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. So I just thought these were fascinating, innovative inventions.
Yeah. That came out of like improvisation due to like limitations and
yeah,
what the skill set needed to be and how what impact you wanted to make. What was the third one? I'm missing the third one.
Well, shit, where did it go?
Sorry.
Planning. Skill set, planning, limitations, and forethought.
Okay.
So the theme here then in my next, to transition into something that's not wartime, is improvised invention kinds of things.
Cool.
Because I read this and I was like, well, I don't just want to talk about like rebel armies and... Because that's not...
Well, better rebel armies than...
Well, yeah. But that's also, like, not about art. That's about destruction and protection and, you know, I don't know. And so I was like, well, what's something that's similar to this? Because I think this skill set that they're deploying is really important and has a lot of value in terms of pushing us as artists.
Mm-hmm.
But what's maybe a more positive or uplifting kind of... aspect. So I started Googling like upcycling and things like that. And I came across this super fascinating article called How Communism Turned Cuba into an Island of Hackers and DIY Engineers.
Amazing. Okay.
And so the conceit here is that because nobody would trade with Cuba after they were became communists, they just didn't have products.
Right.
And so since 1960 until very recently, they are basically just stuck with whatever was on that island and having to reuse and rebuild and repurpose all of these things. So this article cited some examples of like satellite dishes made out of garbage can lids and lunch trays.
Amazing.
Industrial products were tinkered with, and washing machine engines were repurposed to power fans, lawn mowers, shoe repair tools, key copiers, vegetable choppers, coconut shredders.
That's amazing.
I know.
I want a coconut shredder.
Right?
They're so hard to open. You know, in Brooklyn, they like, in the summers, they have like cold coconuts and they have like stands, like hot dog stands or something. But it's usually in the more like, you know, Latino neighborhoods. Yeah. But they have carts of cold coconuts and they have a machete.
Yeah.
And you just like go and they chop it open
chop
for
it
you.
Open.
Give you the juice. Yeah, it's amazing. But like, I've seen that elsewhere, but it's amazing to see in the middle of like Brooklyn, this urban metropolis, you know?
Cool.
Yeah.
In 1992, the Cuban military issued a book called... in English, it's called With Our Own Efforts.
Con
nuestros propios esfuerzos.
Propios esfuerzos?
Yeah.
Okay.
That detail.
Hopefully, Senora Franco will be proud.
And my mom.
Yeah.
Okay. My mom's a Spanish teacher.
Oh, I didn't know that.
At certain points.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. She was a deaf interpreter and a Spanish teacher.
Oh, wow. No sé.
That's why I can sing the Hokey Pokey in Spanish.
That's amazing. I thought that was just a random skill you had, you know? So I don't know.
Yeah. So this book detailed crowdsourced ideas on manipulating and repairing everyday objects And among them was a recipe to turn a grapefruit rind into a steak by marinating it in lemon juice, onion, and garlic and frying it on a pan.
Have you tried that?
No.
We should try that.
Maybe I should do that this week.
Yeah, that's the new thing. Oh, we just blew up our spot.
No, we didn't.
Okay.
Nobody knows yet.
Okay. We didn't do the interview and the provocation already.
We'll cut that out.
Yeah.
So in this article, the person who had taken the photos is Ernesto Oroza, and he is an industrial designer, and he has coined the term architecture of necessity, disobedient technologies, and moral modular.
Oh.
And so he's done a lot of research and writing about this innovative, by necessity, DIY engineering style of architecture in Cuba.
Cool.
So he talks about the high population growth in Havana and the fact that it has not expanded outwards.
Okay.
And he describes the sort of architectural style and the building and the accommodating of new needs. And he compares it to stalagmites and stalactites because it's this fluid movement of materials that just sort of like keep pushing up against each other and sort of changing the shape of the architecture within the city.
Oh, cool.
And he describes this as happening because every life change that happens to a family demands a new configuration of the family home. So okay. If a family, if there's a marriage, now this space has to change because things are packed so tightly that introducing a new person into this space isn't feasible.
Right. You have to accommodate, you have to build a room or change a room or partition a room.
Right. But they also don't have just, you know, like a lot of urban planning going on. They don't have access to a lot of resources. They don't have the capital to like tear it down and build it back up again. And so there's this way in which they build modularly.
Okay.
So he talks about the potential house. And what this is basically a perpetual state of awareness where as you're living in Havana, you're walking through the city and you see everything as a potential module to add on to your home.
Interesting.
A set of used bricks you can acquire, a pile of used cement that you can grab, an abandoned staircase that you can take and move. And so he also used this phrase that an entire house could currently be accumulated as a stack of bricks underneath your bed or behind your sofa. And so you just sort of acquire all of these things and then you build as necessary. This is also really interesting in terms of improvisation because it forces a dual awareness because you have to think about what you need immediately, but you're also trying to think long term.
I see.
And so you're sort of thinking in these two different timelines.
Yeah, you're like navigating time.
Yeah.
And interesting.
You're also navigating legal ramifications because there's still zoning laws.
Okay. I just assumed those would be sort of either changing or changeable.
Yeah, but I mean, government bureaucracy doesn't change. It's just, so he tells this really lovely story about his mother lived in a structure that was too small to legally be considered a house. So he expanded it into a hallway and got it recategorized. And then he wanted to build a roof, but it still wasn't categorized appropriately for that. In order to get a permit to build a roof, he had to have an external staircase.
Okay.
But in order to be allowed to build an external staircase, he had to separate this structure from the abutting structure. And that paperwork was being delayed. And so he starts to think, well, a staircase is a cultural construction. We know what a staircase is because we've all determined that this particular thing is a staircase. But what if I just stack a whole bunch of shit up and it serves the purpose of a staircase? And so on this paperwork, I say there's a staircase, but on this paperwork, I say there's not a staircase. And I'm right in both cases.
Is that what he did?
No, he ended up banking on paperwork delays. So he was like, okay, well, if I build this staircase, that by the time that paperwork gets, like, dealt with, this other paperwork is going to come through, and so that fine is no longer going to be.
I see. Okay.
And so there's.
But that's interesting. Like, a staircase is a cultural construction. Like, then so is everything.
Well, yeah.
Right?
I mean, yeah. So that's really it. That's my cool. whole thing.
Cool.
Just a bunch of random things kind of pieced together.
Yeah, but I think that you gave, like, a nice functional definition of improvisation. Oh, like, yay. Both in, like, art and the real world.
Well, it made me also think about my own artistic practice because, well, I did Odyssey of the Mind growing up. Do you know that?
Mm-hmm. I do. I mean, I didn't do it, but I had friends that did it.
So the whole thing with that is that you have a budget of like $100 and you're trying to build a whole set. I mean, you're also eight, so like what's a set? But it's all about repurposing. And so like we actually went to the dump and gathered materials to yeah. build because that was free and it didn't have to, you know. So we actually built so much stuff out of literal trash in order to stay under budget.
Which, like, we should more. I mean, not to get all political up in here, but, like, that's a part of why, I don't know, our environment is bad, A. B, how the consumer culture gets so impactful, and C, like, I think we're going to be seeing a big change after COVID, after we've
yeah.
been in our homes and, like, not needed to buy, and, like, supply chains got affected, and I think we're going to see a real change in, like, how we deal with objects moving forward.
Yeah, a more creative use of objects and yeah. less taking things for granted, I think.
Totally.
Yeah. So.
And of liveness and people.
Yay!
What I wouldn't give to see a live painting right now.
And a live person.
I know. My cat will have to do. All right.
All right. Art and improvisation.
Woo.
All right, I am so excited to introduce our guest today,
Mr. Bill Perry.
I'm Bill Perry. I'm a pianist slash teacher, and I also am a live performer.
Cool.
I just keep it simple.
Nice, how we like it. So how did you get started in music? What are your beginnings as a jazz musician, another kind of musician?
Well, with jazz, it's kind of a different path. You know, as it were, because initially in my teen years, I started off as a rapper and a break dancer. And I came from the old hip hop culture, you know, from like out of the 80s and 90s and stuff like this. The 80s in particular with break dancing, but 80s and 90s with rapping. And that was my thing. And I used to create my own little music. I had this this thing called a 4-track. Which is like an archaic device today to these kids now, but like it allows you to be able to layer sound effects on one cassette. You know, you had the special kind of cassette. It looked just like your basic like Maxwell cassettes and all that, but there were these certain types of cassettes that you had that allowed you to layer. All right, so in short, it just, you know, I got a keyboard, I got myself a drum machine, and then I ordered. It was such a good feeling because I was like, I don't know, about 17 or so when I ordered this drum machine, and having that come in the mail, like, it's just so elating. And like, you know, I felt like I had arrived or something, and I hadn't even done anything yet. But, you know, then I acquired a keyboard. And so it essentially started off with me making songs for my rap songs. You know, I would write these little raps and everything, and then I would like create my own little compositions because I didn't have a sampler. So, you know, I wasn't able to, you know, to do like, you know, a lot of others that have that stuff, you know, sample some like certain section of a song mm-hmm. and then be able to loop it and then add some layers to it kind of thing. You know, that was kind of a shtick back in the day. But at any rate, so that was my roots, you know.
Okay.
And then I was also a little B-boy.
Yeah.
Oh, did you have a B-boy name?
Oh, okay. Oh, man, nice. You know, no one hasn't asked me that in a while. Fresh Rock.
Yeah,
I was Fresh Rock. You know what I'm saying? All right, so check this out. I had different names. So I was Fresh Rock as a break dancer, which I can still do today. I can still windmill, handspin, backs, all of that.
Wow. Awesome.
Rock, all right. When I tagged, I did graffiti as well. And when I tagged, my name was Whisper.
Okay.
Ooh.
And then my rap name, my first rap name, because I went through a few of those, my very first rap name was Little B.
Okay.
Because as you can see, I'm a little guy over here. So. But anyway, so yeah, that was my whole b-boy. Like, you know, I still got that in me, you know? I mean, like, I play jazz piano and all this and everything, but everybody that knows me knows, like, I walk like a b-boy, you know? But I can talk with the best of them when it comes to jazz and all that, as it were, you know? But, like, you know, yeah, that's my swag. I mean, like, there's more hip-hoppers that like hanging out with me than jazz guys. I mean, I have my jazz friends, but, you know, as a matter of fact, I'm going to Memphis this evening, like I was telling you and everything, Yasi. And that's with a bunch of hip-hoppers. You know, me and like two other rappers and this videographer were going up there, and we're actually doing this TV program called Brit TV up there. And but it's a hip-hop show, man. It's like a 106 in Park meets the Breakfast Club kind of mesh or something, you know?
Cool.
But anyway, I'm kind of, see, you guys got me on a whole other trek. You guys want to hear about my piano stuff and I'm talking about.
No, we want to hear about your artistic pursuits, whatever they may be. So you get to tell us how you feel creative and artistic.
Well, and these things probably intersect in some ways, right? Like your b-boy days and your hip-hop background probably has a huge impact on your approach to jazz music.
As a matter of fact, that's exactly what it has. You know, it's how I more or less discovered jazz. I mean, I had heard jazz off and on like we all had, you know, growing up. But the impressions that it made upon me, like, you know, listening to stuff like Diggable Planets, Gangstar, these kind of rap groups that would mix in jazz with their music. You know, producers like J Dilla that would sample like stuff in the jazz world. You know, DJ Premier, you know, Pete Rock. You know, these are like just, you know, monoliths of hip hop now. You know, but they were the guys with the heat back in the day. And you know, that's the stuff that they sampled. And that made impressions on me. And for me, I took it a little bit further and tried to find out what those songs were, you know. And like, okay, I was talking about my b-boy days to you guys, right? So check this out. Herbie Hancock, he's one of my biggest influences in the jazz world, pianistically speaking, like a lot of us. But I discovered him through the song Rocket, you know. And
cool.
I always looked at Herbie Hancock, I always looked at him as the guy that made breakdance music. I didn't know he was a giant in jazz when I was like in my early teens, because I was all like breakdancing the Rocket, you know, and that was off of an album he had called Future Shock, where he was becoming more and more electronic. But you know, that just, you know, it's just like he was going into another phase at that time, but he was a piano giant, which I discovered later, you know, but at that time, I was just like, oh, yeah, Herbie Hancock. Yeah, the breakdancing composer or whatever how I looked at him back then. It's just so funny I look at that now.
Well, I actually saw him in Kuwait last year. And it was like totally like spaced out electronic show. And I definitely think there was some there were some audience members who were expecting the piano side of Herbie Hancock and were like,
very confused.
Yeah.
Hey, the same one that you're talking about, that same tour, he came here to Mississippi right before he went on, and I saw him in Tunica, Mississippi.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, Oh, I was about to make a slip.
You and your ex-wife went and saw Herbie Hancock?
I was saying that I have to get used to saying ex-wife because I just got freshly divorced. It's weird, though, because at this point in time, I didn't look at having to get back into dating again, and I've been kind of testing the waters, but it's been all kind of different things. I mean, Yasi, I mean, the reason why our friendship exists is because of, like, DM relationships, you know, between your mother and I.
That's
and stuff,
true.
You know?
So, Hattie, I don't know if you know how I know Bill, but
I know he's your piano teacher.
That's right, because my mom saw him and his dad and his sister play on the Mississippi Blues Trail and then became friends with them on Facebook, then knew Bill was like a really talented pianist. And when I bought a piano, she's like, well, I have a piano teacher for you if he's interested. And so reached out to him, and here we are. So, yeah.
Well,
indeed. All goes down in the deal.
It's a strange world.
Like I'm telling y'all.
When you're online dating, how early do you tell them that you're a jazz musician? How does this impact your dating life?
Well, okay, in my case, a lot of them, that's kind of how they end up knowing me is through my music.
Okay.
And then they'll like show, you know, either it depends, maybe, you know, if they like communicate with me and they show interest in my music, And then it's, you know, we actually kind of start like maybe making a connection via DMs. And then, you know, maybe that would translate into a messenger call or something, you know. And, but that hasn't happened a lot, you know, like, honestly, I think that's only happened. Well, it's only happened once in regards to wanting to get to know someone. It's happened twice in another instance, but.
Cool. I know nothing about breakdancing other than like seeing it a few times here or there, but I imagine that there is an element.
I'm going to interrupt you just a second. Hold on. My very first essay I wrote in grad school was on the performance of masculinity in breakdancing and about like the Hegelian master-slave dynamic and dialectics and like, yeah, all of that. It was nerdy.
Whoa!
Well, Hattie used to go to like competitions, I did, right? You watched.
Yeah, I lived in Phoenix for a while. And so I attended on a sort of regular basis breaking events.
Well, what I was going to say is I imagine there's an element of improvisation, right? And probably also with graffiti and definitely with the jazz music. So like what is your mindset like when you're improvising?
That's a good question. It's like language, you know, I mean, like right now we all know the English language as it were, you know, I mean, we, for the most part for purposes, we know how to get our point across, you know, maybe we throw some incorrect grammar or some, that's kind of how improvisation is as it were. Well, I mean, to some degree, I guess it is like that where you're just pulling from the moment, you know, the moment as it were, as it exists. And that's where your mind is. There's a lot of different emotional layers to it, too. Mm. You know, like there's, you know, depending on your mood, as it were, you know, if you're in a somber mood, if you're in a joyous mood and so on and so forth. And how you emote that through your instrument. And that's also, you know, in the moment, you know, it's one of those things where it's in that moment as you feel, you know, and like, okay, so there's that kind of component. But then there is this one night where there was this girl that I'd really been liking had showed up at my gig and she was sitting in the front where I could see her, you know, and like this solo came out of me, ladies. Like, I mean,
it cuts out at all the good parts. I know.
Bill, you're cutting out again at all the good parts.
With all the good parts. We hear all the transitions and know the story.
Oh my god. Oh no, I was okay, so what I was saying was like, yeah, she was in the audience, she caught my eye, and this incredible solo came out of me. But yeah, so you know, I was just looking at her, and we were just in this really flirty way, you know? And so I was just soloing off this jazz ballad we were doing, and at the end of the evening, she gave me her phone number.
Oh, so improvisation affected yeah. real life.
It's like, and again, it just depends on the moment. And then there's those gigs where, you know, like I've been privy to play in front of like 10, 15, 20,000 people before. And it does something to you, man, you know, and it's just as well if the energy is right with like 50 people in the room, yeah. you know, if the energy is right. I mean, it's not easy to define improvisation, but at the end of the day, it's rooted in simplicity, if that makes
sense. It's rooted in simplicity is what you said.
It feels like it's kind of euphoric in a sense, you know. It's like a state of zen, as it were, because you're completely immersed in the moment. You completely acknowledge the present, and you're quickly trying to discern that moment in fragments, you know, in the midst of improvisation, you know, be it in dance, you know, music, visual arts and so on, you know, you're trying to capture the essence of that moment, you know? I mean, it's funny, you know, in essence, I actually, for all intents and purposes, I started off as a dancer first. I was a b-boy before I was a musician, and I interpreted like my moment, like, you know, when a breakdancer gets down, he's not being methodical beyond like what moves he's planning or she plans on doing, you know, if they're going to go down and do a backspin or a windmill and so on and so forth, you know, that's in the moment, you know? And, but now the move in itself, they, you know, for those that are highly skilled in whatever move they're about to do, you appreciate the move, you know, and are enthralled by the move, just like somebody improvising some music in the moment. You're really enthralled in the music in that moment, and they're interpreting that moment, in its essence. That's what improvisation is to me.
Since it's so timely, is it weird to like go back and listen to your past improvisations?
No, not at all. Not for me. I know there's a lot of musicians like that. But no, for me personally, I like to, time travel, as it were.
Yeah, that's what it feels like it would be. It's like you're entering other moments that have passed, but I don't know. Cool.
But you got to be careful of that, because sometimes I'll get to listening to myself. And, there are certain things that there's certain knowledge that I've acquired now that I'll hear those limitations and I'll feel myself pulling towards the things that I do know now that I know I didn't know then, but was trying to, pull towards. And I can get a little anal about that, I don't know. It's not good to judge your past self, like that. Cause it's like, you know better now kind of thing. What are you doing?
Do you feel like you have to prepare yourself to get into a state of mind where improvisation is possible, or is this, does it just come like easily or naturally to you?
I think it's actually both, Hattie. It's a little bit of both, because you're trying to capture the moment, but it's the moment based on how you perceive it. It's not necessarily whimsical, as it were, because you're not just doing something that has no structure, as it were. It's like vocally speaking, like when you're singing, you know what the tune is, but maybe you interpret it your own way, as it were. You're singing along to the song, but maybe you add some other little nuances to it. The same could be said with an instrument, in that same respect. And, I'm kind of struggling to kind of give you a really good answer with this, because it's not a definitive answer. There's no definitive answer. But I mean, that kind of knocks on the door. But I think all of us, musicians and perhaps artists in general, can agree that it's about interpreting the moment and that instance in particular, your own perspective of that moment, and try to bring something out of it that lies within you.
Do you feel like you're shaping a goal in those moments? I'm also thinking about this story you just told us about the woman in the front. Like, were you trying to get her to give you her number?
No, that's the thing.
And just musically, like, be like, give me your number, give me your number.
No, that's the thing. No, there was no intended goal there. And I was actually shocked by that. And it was a pleasant shock, but yeah, I was shocked. But no, it developed in the moment. See, that's I'm glad you brought that back up, because that was an improv moment, as it were. That was not planned. It was not premeditated. We didn't have her to come in and strategically sit in front of me so I could, flirt with her and all this. And it happened in the moment. And I didn't think that what I was doing was going to make any kind of impression upon her that would, make her give me her number at the end of the night. I mean, no, I was like, whoa. And of course, all the guys are giving me dap and everything. I'm just like, man, I had no idea. I went home like scratching my head, man. Like,
that's awesome. So as an artist, how do you think you see the world differently than an average person?
Wow. Well, one thing that I noticed amongst the artistic minded, and not just necessarily musicians, just, as I was saying, people in the theater arts. I got friends in theater, I got visual artists and writers, and, thinking abstractly, thinking outside of the box is what I find as a common denominator that sets us apart from those that do not think in such a way. That doesn't necessarily mean one is, on a higher level of consciousness or better and so on and so forth. I don't come from that kind of place, but rather, perception. Being able to see something that others perhaps see some simplicity in, and you can see an angle on it. It's not so flat surface to you. There's more depth and dimension to it. And you choose to want to express that, there's a lot of ways one looks at things. I mean, like in the visual arts, for example, consider the way, say, Rembrandt, expressed himself,
And then fast forward in time and they look at what Jackson Pollock did. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, and it's a matter of perception and interpretation and how the art makes one feels, you know? And because to a lot of people like Jackson Pollock, you know, they're like, man, that's just like scribble scrabble and, you know, kids can do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But like, I don't mind abstract expressionism. He did this piece called Autumn Rhythm. It was like back in 1953 or something. And to me, when I look at that, it's abstract, but it looks like autumn to me, you know, and it feels mm-hmm. like autumn when I'm looking at that piece. It feels like autumn, you know, you don't see any leaves or trees or anything that would like give it some sort of like pastoral scenic kind of view, as it were. You know, it's just, it emotes, at least for me personally. You know, I've shown that piece or I've told that piece to others and then we'll show them like a picture via the internet or something, which, you know, it never gives it justice when you're showing somebody artwork through your phone, you know, and you're trying to make an impression on them and they're like, oh man, look at that. No, I mean, that ain't nothing. You're like, man, if you saw this in real life though, or something, you know, it maybe would make more of an impression on you. But yeah, so at any rate, getting back to my whole overall point is like, you know, it's a matter of how one interprets it and being bold enough to put your improv work out there. Because when something is improv, people are even more, you know, particular about, you know, how they were interpreted. And if it's recorded, if, you know, especially like in the jazz world, a lot of our stuff, you know, is recorded for all time. And I've heard solos that I did that mm-hmm. I'm just like, oh my God. And that's on a recording, you know, and I got a costume deal with that little book that I did, you know, and I was just trying to find my little whatever, you know, as I'm improvising. But, you know, that's going to happen just like in speech. You know, sometimes we slur in our speech and we, you know, trip over our tongues and stuff like this. And it's going to happen. And you just have to be comfortable in your skin. See, that's another component to improvisation. You have to be comfortable with yourself. Mm.
So you teach improvisational piano. How do you teach that, that presence, that courage, that comfort?
Well, actually, what I kind of do is more or less like I teach the rules. Yeah, it's like I give my students a foundation that they can, you know, as Yossi can attest to, you know, going through the rules, as it were, you know, giving the music
structure. I'm playing a lot of scales.
Indeed.
Or I should be playing a lot of skills.
Yes, as you should. You know.
Yeah, I need to practice more. I know.
Anybody that's worth their salt pianistically, that's their thing. You know what I mean? And it's just about strengthening your foundation. So the better you understand the rules and the language and the terminology and thus and so, the better you're equipped to have those moments of improvisation. Like, for example, language. Like, you know, my vocabulary is a lot better now and I can reach and grab a lot of words that I couldn't grab, say, maybe 20 years ago or so. That, you know, certain words that are in my vocabulary now that I'm going to give you guys a funny story that I always like telling people because they're always talking about how articulate I am and this, that, and the other. And I always tell the story. All right. The word ubiquitous. All right. I had never heard anyone pronounce that word. I read that word when I first was introduced to that word. I read it in something and I was too ashamed to ask anyone what the word sounded like. Cause you know, my damn pride and all this, I didn't want to seem stupid or whatever, you know? So one day we're in a conversation and I'm talking to this lady who was a grad student. Actually, she was a friend girl of mine and we're having this great conversation. And I knew what the word ubiquitous meant. So it was an advantageous moment for me to like use that word. So here I go to go say the word. Here I go, ladies. I say ubiquitous.
Yes.
Okay.
And the girl, like, she looks up at me and she's just like, you mean ubiquitous? And she kind of gives me this look like, you're trying too hard, man. You're trying way too hard.
Well, that's not very nice.
Well, but no, actually, I deserve it because I was trying too hard. You know what I'm saying?
Awesome.
So it was one of those kind of learning lessons. But, you know, the overall point was I was improvising in the moment. I had discovered a new word that I had added to my vocabulary and I saw a moment to use it, but I had never been schooled on how to use the word, you know, as in terms of pronunciation. I use it in the right manner, but I didn't say it right. Which still made me sound crazy. You know what I mean? It's kind of like, you guys, I don't know if you guys are hip to the old term. It's putting the wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those kind of moments, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it actually reminds me of what we actually say when we're, like, teaching improvisation and acting is, like, one of the most important things that you need to learn right off the bat is, like, the comfort in failing.
Yes.
Because, like, you will fail. You will fail, and then you just get back up and you go again. And, like, once you can get past that fear of failing, then you're good to go. Would you say that that's true in your understanding of improvisation, your experience?
No. That is right on point. That is right on point, man. Yes, I agree. Because, you know, again, you're putting yourself out there. You know, it's like you're being, as it were, you know, artistically naked before the world, as it were. And, you know, you're revealing yourself and you have to be, you know, I don't know. You have to, like you say, you know, not be afraid of failure. And in some ways, kind of, you know, it's going to sound crazy to say it like this, but kind of being shameless, you know, not having any shame, you know, to put yourself out there like that, you know, which I think kind of runs in conjunction with, you know, being accepting of failure if it comes upon, like, you know, say, speaking in the proverbial way of being naked and they make fun of your nakedness, as it were. And you're just like, oh, no, oh, God, you know.
This is also, in a lot of ways, similar to the conversation we had on vulnerability recently, where it's so much, you have to take the risk in order to get to the greatness, right? In order to, like, find that creativity and, like, do something new, do something inventive, do something interesting. And without that risk, then you're never going to get there, really.
Oh, my goodness. It's funny that you say that. That's kind of hitting towards my provocation, actually.
Oh, well, we're actually right at the time where we were going to transition to it. So should we do that?
Sure.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, it was more or less what Hattie was just saying, actually, more or less almost verbatim.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Ready?
Awesome. Awesome. That is so awesome, man. But yeah, man, I wanted to challenge, you know, your listening audience there, man, to, you know, to try something new that they've always wanted to try, but kind of had a fear of wanting to try, you know, like if they've always wanted to, you know, play chess, or if they've always wanted to so on, you know, to try something, you know, and really challenge themselves to, like, really, you know, put forth an effort to really doing it, not like, you know, trying it and then, you know, failing at the first attempt and then giving up, but giving themselves, you know, perhaps, you know, give themselves, like, you know, 14 days, 2 weeks solid.
Okay, cool. I love that.
Would that be too much to ask?
Part of the challenge here is also, like, being honest with yourself and picking something that you, like, actually want to try, and, like, not just, like, some piddly little, like, I'm going to collect leaves for 14 days.
Right, right. Yeah. Like, yeah, I don't want you to pick something that's just going to bore you, like, collecting stamps or something or whatever. You know? It's like, nah. You know, no offense to anyone that collects stamps or whatever, but, you know, I mean, come on.
Right. Something that challenges your comfort.
Right.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
That's actually my favorite icebreaker question. I don't know where I got it, but I love asking people, when was the last time you did something new?
Oh.
Because for many of us, it's been a long time.
Oh, yeah. No, I had brought up chess because, you know, that was something that I had wanted to do a while back that I had started trying. And, like, I am, like, a chess nut now. I'm, like, completely addicted to it. But it was something that I was always kind of afraid of challenging myself. But, you know, all my, like, you know, smarty, farty friends, man, you know, it was, like, making me feel stupid. Like, Bill, you just still playing checkers, man, like a kid, man. You got to learn how to play some chess, man. And now I'm, like, kicking some of their butts in the game, you know.
Yeah, so are you beating them now? I believe you're beating them now.
Awesome.
Well, a couple of them, man. I mean, just to keep it real, I mean, the majority of them are kicking my ass.
All right. Well, hey, you have time, you know, practice.
But yeah, so there's my provocation, man.
Well, piano was mine, so all right. I'll pick a new one. But piano's been mine. That was something I've always wanted to do my whole life, so it's been awesome.
Yeah, that's what your mom was telling me and everything, you know, and I think that's cool that you challenge yourself to do it. And I mean, me personally, I'm having a great time. I hope you are too.
Oh, I am. It's been awesome. So yeah, it was not easy, right? Like it takes work and it takes commitment. So
no
I love this challenge. I love this provocation. Cool.
Cool.
And by the way, I am going to challenge more, Yasi, you know, because you challenged me to challenge you more. So that's something I want.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. You asked for I'm it. A little worried now.
But hey, you know, Hattie, it's also been nice meeting you and everything, you know, you for the too. First time. And this has been a pleasure. And I hope to be back on the show and maybe have some better tech, you know, situations and I actually throw the visuals for you guys.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Yeah.
Anytime. But yeah, but it's been our pleasure for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Super fun conversation. Great meeting you.
Likewise. Thank you guys so much for having me on here.
Awesome. Thanks, Bill, so much for chatting with us. And I promise I'm practicing my scale.
And thank you, listeners, for listening.
Yeah.
If you want to know more about anything or anyone that came up on today's show, be sure to check out those show notes.
And do the provocation. Get out there and really commit to trying something new. And don't give up when you fail. Keep going, friendly. Yeah, not if.
Not
That's
if.
The rule of improvisation. Not if, but when you fail. Get back on that horse for 14 days at least. We do it, so you should do it too. And when you do it, tag us at Art If Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast as much as we are. Be sure to tune in next week when Yasi and I talk about art and education just as the school year is about to start, and then we chat with educational counselor and upcycle artist Michaela Beatty. Be sure to rate and review us wherever you're listening.
Art If Podcast is produced by
Hattie Cry
and Yasi Jahanmir.
Our theme music was composed by Muhammad Abdul Salam.
Follow us at Art If Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to stay up to date on upcoming episodes and to join our vibrant community of artists.